20 years after the off-Broadway debut of David Ives' All in the Timing, Primary Stages has mounted a new production at 59 East 59 Theaters. And the play still got it. Timing, that is. Its visual puns and verbal pyrotechnics feel as inventive, hilarious, and relevant as they must have when our Google, Wikipedia, and Facebook-deprived ancestors first saw it way back in 1993. And it turns out that we still have much in common with those ancient audiences. Men still try to pick up women in coffee shops. We've yet to adopt a universal language, and Philadelphia is still considered some kind of geographic black hole. During the show, Philip Glass will buy a loaf of bread. Trotsky will struggle with the news of his death, and a roomful of monkeys on typewriters will try once again to come up with Hamlet. All in the Timing's run has just been extended to April 14th, and I'm very pleased that it brings playwright David Ives back to our show, along with actor Carson Elrod. Hello.
Hello.
Greetings.
And David, reading that introduction made me feel very old all of a sudden, because it occurs to me that the first time we ever met was when you came on the show to discuss All in the Timing in 1993.
Yes. It's odd going back to these plays because I scarcely recognize the person who wrote them. But it is a delight to revisit these humble little pieces with a brilliant cast at Primary Stages again. So, it's odd because I don't even write like this anymore, but I sit at the audience and note some jokes that I'm not ashamed of.
And you haven't changed anything?
I changed about half a dozen words, which, oddly enough, had become outmoded. We had the word VCR in the show. We had the word payphone in the show. What is that? And we had the Concorde, which I thought was the future and turned out to be a definite part of the past.
Was this new production proposed partly because of the success of Venus and Fur?
Well, maybe. I don't know.
I know it is produced a lot in colleges.
It is produced all the time, high school competitions, colleges. In fact, I think everybody who came into the audition room for All in the Timing paused long enough to say, I have to tell you, I did this play in high school or in college.
Was that true of you, Carson?
Yeah, absolutely.
Because you probably didn't see the original production.
No, I didn't, although I am friends with Robert Stanton, and I think he's one of America's most brilliant actors. And so when I found out about this, I knew that I had big, tall shoes to fill. But when I first auditioned for David and John Rando in 2000 or 2001 for David's play Polish Joke, I was one of, I'm sure, a parade of actors who came through the door to tell David about my experience with All in the Timing. In college at the University of Kansas, our fabulous teacher and director, Jack Wright, took us to a theater festival in Liège, Belgium, where we did Words, 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 and I played Swift then as now, and I played Ramon in Variations on the Death of Trotsky. So yes, I did have a college. I experimented with David Ives in college.
I should mention, though, that Swift is actually a monkey trying to type Hamlet.
Yes. So a very angry monkey.
Very angry monkey.
And did it all come back to you?
Well, I'm not playing Ramon in this one, so I didn't have to let it come back to me. Swift, I think that, I think that some of the choices that I made in college probably inform the choices that I'm making now, but I'm also just very lucky to have John Rando and David Ives in the room to help guide me towards a new performance for 2013.
When you're playing a monkey, do you create a backstory for the character?
Well, sure. I mean, and what's great is I approach every play similarly. David's written a great set of given circumstances, and that's where actors start.
Well, it is also important that you put together the right cast, because just like the title, it's all in the timing. And this is really ensemble work.
Yes, we are blessed. And not only are these actors wonderful, but they take care of each other on and off stage. And so it is a true company. It's a real company of players.
Well, you've said that you learn much about playwriting from listening to music. Is that where one of the ideas for we have the Philip Glass piece here that is literally about music, But you get the feeling that you're thinking, even though this was a different playwright, you say, yes, a younger version of you, you're thinking very much of point, counterpoint,
yes,
fugue.
When I write a play, I sit and read it to myself, and it's the music of the words and the sort of meter and the changes in tempo and things that really interest me. And so if it doesn't sound good, I feel I failed. In fact, one thing that I'm actually very bad at, despite my apparent reputation for comedy, is that I really don't write jokes. I sort of write things that sound funny. And so I feel I'm not a Paul Rudnick or a Chris Durang or a Neil Simon. I can't write a joke to save my life.
So you write funny situations, and then the humor just grows out,
yes,
of that.
Yes, it's like put three monkeys in a room trying to type Hamlet, and it writes itself in a funny way.
I've always wondered about that. Why do you think the idea that if monkeys typed into infinity, they would eventually wind up typing Hamlet? Is Hamlet an arbitrary idea? Wouldn't a Dr. Seuss book be more likely?
I'm not exactly sure where that hypothetical came from, but it was certainly one that I had heard of before I had any experience with these plays. Just as Swift says, it's a test of the inadvertent virtues of randomness, and somebody came up with this idea to explain that given infinity, this would happen eventually.
Before Shakespeare, actually, people used to say that three monkeys typing into infinity would type a David Ives play, but nobody knew what that was
yet.
So Shakespeare came along.
Well,
yes.
Does typing into infinity describe your writing process?
No, actually, handwriting into infinity describes my process. I've gone through so many cases of Bic Blue medium point pens in the course of my life that I wish I'd bought stock in it as a child.
So you're one of those people who insists on writing in longhand first.
I absolutely have to write in longhand, and when I sit down to type it into finished form, I cannot change anything or it instantly turns into slop. It's the writing it on the page and getting all of those hand-picking every word, literally, that kind of makes it feel right to me.
Well, I've read that you have been, that you've wanted to be a playwright since you were nine, but you were also interested in math and science, weren't you?
No, I actually failed math and science.
Because some reviewers have suggested that you might have been influenced by the theories of quantum physics.
Yes. What are those? I don't even know what quantum physics is. So
they're reading things into you.
No, I was let out of advanced algebra, so I'm afraid that's not really my bailiwick.
On the other hand, you say that that during your academic career, you wound up writing a play about Spinoza because you were avoiding doing real work.
I've said so many things. I'm amazed to hear myself say that. But
this is the problem with the internet, isn't it?
No, I think I'm being misquoted by somebody. I wrote the play about the excommunication of Spinoza called New Jerusalem because I was sitting in an airport and I was reading a book in which I read that somebody asked Einstein if he believed in God, and Einstein's answer was, I believe in Spinoza's God. And I started reading about Spinoza and thought he would make a wonderful play. So it was an airport, a book, and a quote.
And for a long time, you wrote a bunch of plays, and then there was a period where you were writing adaptations of other people's work. Then Venus and Fur came along, which is not really an adaptation.
Well, in a funny way, it is an adaptation because it kind of takes the famous Austrian pornographic novel and mixes it in with a story from today. But yes, I have to say that a lot of what I do is adaptation, partly because it takes the burden off coming up with a brilliant idea every morning after breakfast. So lately I've been actually translating 17th century French verse comedies and having a wonderful time, I must say.
And you're nodding your head, Carson. You know about these?
Yes, and I've been very fortunate to be involved. My first professional David Ives production was with this director, John Rando, at the Williamstown Theater Festival in 2008 doing David Ives' adaptation of Feydeau's A Flea in Her Ear, which was incredibly rewarding. And then at the Shakespeare Theater of D.C. in 2011, I got to do the premiere of his The Heir Apparent, which was just one of these translations.
And, now, and also won a Best Acting Award for playing that servant and three other parts at the same time.
Well, that's the thing about David's work, and I think why actors have a crush on him so much is that he writes plays for actors. These plays, these parts are so rich and so varied. I mean, it's kind of, a no-brainer that I would get noticed for the part that I did down in D.C. because, as he said, the part that he's written is a servant character who, over the course of a 2.5-hour play, impersonates five other people. So the actor playing that role doesn't just play that role. The actor gets to do six parts. I mean, it's a party.
And you get to do about five parts in this one.
Yes, I'm, again, very happy right now.
Beginning with a scene in which a man is trying to pick up a woman in a coffee shop. David, should I attach any significance to the fact that the playbill notes that it's a rainy night? Did it have to be a rainy night?
Well, it's a romance, this play. It is a young woman reading and all alone in a coffee shop one night, and to make it more romantic, what's better than rain, you know? The rain in Casablanca, in the train scene in Casablanca is the most romantic thing in the world, so what the heck, let it rain, you know?
Yeah. And you are in that scene.
Yes.
Beautiful. Again, it's all in the timing with Liv Ruth.
Yes.
By the way, I should
wonderful.
Point out that everyone in this cast, Liv Ruth, Matthew Saldivar, Jen Harris, are all...
Eric Clem, yes.
All just work wonderfully together. I don't know
it's
whether...
It's a really magic group.
Anyway, you have this thing... I don't know how much we want to reveal about it, but...
I don't think there's
start
any...
up a conversation.
I don't
and
think
then,
well, they start up a conversation and every time they say something, shall we say, objectionable
or
unacceptable, a deal breaker in the conversation going forward, the conversation stops and goes back and picks up again and corrects itself. So it's kind of an autocorrect conversation.
But you've called that play Sure Thing.
I call it Sure Thing.
Is anything but a sure
it's
thing.
It's anything but a sure thing, of course. But they, I must, well, I shouldn't say whether they get together at the end.
Well, actors always tell me that one of the main objectives of acting is to stay in the moment. Is that made easier by the hairpin turns that you go through in these plays?
Yes, it is. And Sure Thing actually was probably the one that I had the hardest time learning and memorizing because there are so many subtle variations on a theme. You know, I talked to
you
David.
Could fall into a pattern and say really, that because you're saying the same
yes,
thing sometimes.
Yes, and you can. You could end up painting yourself into a circle. And, I think our second preview, Liv and I ended up, in a thing of what's the book? Faulkner, have you read it? What's the book? Faulkner, have you read it? What's the book? Faulkner, have you read it? You know, I mean, I think we did end up, in kind of a acting death spiral in the second preview, but we've got a hold on it now.
And nobody noticed.
Nobody noticed.
It's like doing a third repeat in a Philip Glass
exactly.
opera.
But the answer to your question is, do these plays help you stay in the moment? Absolutely, they do. And, from a Buddhist point of view, the monks often have a bell. And the whole point of that bell is to bring them back into the room that they're in, to be in the present moment. And so it's kind of nice to have this kind of Buddhist meditation bell going, ding, stay here, ding, stay here, ding, stay here.
And in the case of Philip Glass, is that based on a real Philip Glass piece?
Because
no. The words do obviously have a musicality.
Yes, Philip Glass is a 5 minute and 38 second, what would we call it, choral work for four actors in which Philip Glass attempts to buy a loaf of bread and everybody speaks in rhythm. And
but because of John Rando, it's so much more than just a choral piece. I mean, Rando has built like a movement vocabulary that goes along with David's brilliant.
So where you moving to on the stage is important as well.
Well, I think it's fun.
Yes, it's comedy epic, and it is the spirit of John Rando. We are so, when people go see plays, they often think they're seeing the work of playwrights, but they're actually so much seeing the work of directors. And in this case, this whole evening is infused with the comic joy of John Rando, yep. and particularly Philip Glass Buys a Loaf of yep. Bread, which is because I only wrote the words and the rhythms, and he gave it a visual life.
It's a directing tour de force.
Although there are some direct playwrights who want to direct their own plays. I have a feeling you like the idea of somebody else doing it. There's one of the things is universal language. I'd imagine that was the hardest thing for you to learn.
Everybody makes that assumption, and I can completely understand why, but it was actually the easiest one for me to learn because David has written exactly what each line means underneath.
A couple of lines?
Yes. Actually, we should explain that the universal language is a language teacher teaching a language called Unamunda to a woman with a stutter named Dawn.
Played by Jen Harris brilliantly.
Played brilliantly. And
we have very little time, unfortunately.
Okay. Let me see.
I'm going to go from
Gavat Kennedy Dupe for you. I've just come into his okay. into his office.
Hetz auf Dada Unamunda Kakademi et Gavat Kennedy Dupe for you.
Well, I saw this ad in the newspaper.
Video de clip in the paper. And et Kinnish?
It says, learn Unamunda, the universal language.
Lick Unamunda, the lingua l'universal.
The language that will unite all humankind.
The lingua hetbarf una diversify all of the peoples into vold.
It's almost like listening to Swedish.
Swedish, Russian, German. Hats off, Dada Unamunda Kakademi.
And Carson is...
And fun to write, I assume.
Oh, God, it was so much fun. I'm sure my neighbors wondered what the hell was going on because they could hear me through the wall saying things like that.
Well, it's been extended to April 14th.
Yes.
And then because of some of these theaters like 59 East, 59th Street, something else probably is scheduled to come in.
Something else to move in, yes. And but we will be as funny for as long as we can at 59 East 59. And I must say I am so blessed with this cast.
And the cast that we are talking about are Eric Clem, Carson Elrod, Jen Harris, Liv Ruth, and Matthew Saldivar, all brilliant at doing comedy. And I'm sorry we didn't talk about Peter and the Starcatcher.
Oh, that's okay.
I'm
very happy to talk about this.
This is at 59 East 59 Theater, and my thanks to David Ives and Carson Elrod for being with us today.
So great to be here.
Thank you for having us on.